And joining us on the Book Club on Perspectives today is Dr. Kyle Longley. Dr. Longley is a Snell Family Dean's Distinguished Professor of History and Political Science at Arizona State University. He's the author of numerous books, including In the Eagle's Shadow, The United States in Latin America, Senator Albert Gore Sr., and The Morenci Marines, A Tale of Small Town and the Vietnam War. And his latest book is called LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. Kyle, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Oh, it's my great pleasure to be talking to people back home.
So tell us a little bit about your interest. I know that you write in your book about how you were very young when you used to drive by the Johnson Ranch and your parents pointed it out to you. So have you always been interested in history and writing and reading?
Well, yes. My father was a social science teacher there in West Texas for most of his career. He taught for over 43 years. And so, you know, our dinner table conversations always revolved around history and political science and current events. So it was always sort of first and foremost, although I have to admit, until my senior year of college, I was a math major before I switched over to become a historian.
So tell me, when you would drive by the Johnson Ranch and your parents pointed it out to you, you were, I think, you know, 5 or 6 years old back then.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about how did that impact you?
Well, I think it just sort of planted a seed. You know, it was just one of those things where living in Central Texas, you always knew the legacy of LBJ. I mean, you just go to Austin, for example, and just walk around, and there's Lake Lady Bird, and there's the Wildflower Center, and there's the LBJ Library. And you, if you know anything about Central Texas, it would not have developed the way it did without LBJ's intervention, in both as a congressman and senator, and ultimately as president.
1968, LBJ's 1968 is the name of your book. And the picture in the front, very famous picture for people who are in history and have seen this picture. And just looking at it, you see a very defeated man, so much anguish, so much anxiety. And just, as you mentioned about getting into his mind and seeing what's going on, that picture tells so much.
Well, that's why we chose it for the front cover. I mean, there were a number of pictures we could have, but that one just jumped out. I mean, he's sitting there listening to a tape recording from his son-in-law, who is a lieutenant in the Marine Corps in Vietnam, and he's listening how he had lost several men and the anguish that that just creates for him. And I think the final part, and there's an ironic part to it also, is in the background is JFK's bust, overlooking him, sort of like he had lived over him this whole presidency and sort of been the ghost hovering over him.
You know, I just noticed that. And so my question would be, did 1963, was that the year that perhaps led to all of this that was going to trouble him through his presidency?
I think so. I mean, you look at Johnson inherited, and I talk about this extensively in the book, that Vietnam is central to the whole being of Lyndon Johnson by 1968. And in 1963, John Kennedy basically leaves a horrible mess on LBJ's desk with the assassination of Diem, the United States-supported president in South Vietnam, and it just deteriorates from that point forward to the point by July of 1965, the decision is made to put large numbers of U.S. troops in Vietnam.
You open the book with the State of the Union address that he gave, and in that speech, he sort of had the idea of announcing that he would not seek re-election, but at the same time, people were wondering, is he going to announce that or not? People close to him.
Right. People close to him. Only a very small group of people even knew that he had created a ending to the speech for the State of the Union, announcing that he would not seek re-election. Ultimately, he does not follow through on that, arguing later to his press secretary, George Christians, that, you know, how can I ask the Congress for all these things that I just outlined in the State of the Union and then turn around and quit? And so he pulls off at that, and then after that, you know, the shocks just keep coming with the Pueblo and Tet and everything related to Vietnam, and, you know, that's going to change some of the dynamic where he reaches the point by March 31st.
So let's talk a little bit about the Pueblo incident.
Yeah.
This is something that came across, and he, at first, I'm not sure if, when I read your book, as far as was he fully aware of everything that was going on. And then at the same time, there were people on both sides pulling at him, you need to attack, you need to get those people out of there, you need to do this. And people don't realize, I guess, until later in reading your book and in history, how close we were to perhaps President Johnson launching some nukes at North Korea.
Right. Well, the North Koreans have been very provocative, and I think a lot of people, especially younger people, won't know what the Pueblo was, and it was basically the North Koreans seizing a U.S. intelligence ship off their coast and then holding 82 American sailors hostage. And there was this great debate, you know, what do we do? And unfortunately, Johnson showed a good, even-tempered approach to it, because those pushing him to basically nuke the place, he was like, well, there goes the 82 hostages. And that's our goal, is ultimately to get those people out. And, you know, he goes so far as to say, I'd meet with Kim Il-sung, the grandfather of our current nemesis, in those streets naked if it meant getting back the hostages.
And as you mentioned, the grandfather of the current leader of North Korea. So these problems go back, way back when. It's not just something that just came up all of a sudden in the news.
No, and that's what I talk about extensively in the book. There is a lot that resonates from 1968 to today and 2018, one being the North Koreans tweaking us whenever they get the opportunity, and us not knowing how to respond because we have no real understanding of the North Koreans, and especially their leadership.
We are visiting with Professor Kyle Longley. The latest book that he has out is LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. A lot of people, when they think of LBJ and they see him speaking on TV or on YouTube, whatever they're looking at, the first thing that comes to the mind, of course, is the assassination of President Kennedy, and that's what elevated President Johnson to the presidency. But then, as you mentioned, he inherited a lot of problems, a lot of things that were left undone, because obviously President Kennedy didn't know what something was going to happen to him. But the number one thing that a lot of people identify with President Johnson is the Vietnam War.
Well, and that's the sad part of it is many would argue that without the Vietnam War, Lyndon Johnson might have gone down as one of the most prominent presidents in American history for all that he did for education and the environment, for Medicare, for the elderly, civil rights. I mean, that's where the most substantial gains occur since Reconstruction during the Johnson presidency. But unfortunately, Vietnam becomes sort of that overlapping cloud that he can never escape.
And in the book, you mentioned when he's talking to his cabinet and then also talking to his generals, he's kind of getting different messages, different feelings from both sides.
Oh, definitely so. And this is going to occur from 1963 forward. And, you know, the part is a lot of people like to argue, well, Kennedy wouldn't have got us in this mess. And my argument always to the contrary is Kennedy's advisors were the ones that became Johnson's advisors, and they became the most hawkish group, Walt Rostow, Robert McNamara, Dean Russ. These were all inherited from Kennedy. So, you know, this stage for what was going to happen was likely to happen no matter what, because we couldn't establish a stable regime in Saigon, and that kept us having to incorporate more and more U.S. troops just to prevent Saigon from falling.
Tell us about General Westmoreland.
Well, General Westmoreland is, you know, in his own mind, you know, he's the savior and the hero of Vietnam. If we just listened to him more closely, everything would have worked out better. And that somehow the press stabbed us in the back, Congress stabbed us in the back. But, and the reality is, you see Johnson already moving Westmoreland out by 1968. He's ultimately going to be, by the summer of 1968, replaced by Creighton Abrams. And there's a lot of tensions there, but really the tensions rise where Johnson's getting a lot of his bad advices from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Earl Wheeler.
When you're talking about the bad advice and what they're getting, what he's getting from his cabinet, what he's getting from the generals, the Tet Offensive is one example where President Johnson is going, wait a minute, I thought you said blank.
Right.
So what happened with the Tet Offensive?
Well, what the Tet Offensive was, it just demonstrated to them, to a lot of people, including those closest to the president, that what had been coming out of Saigon, both from the military leaders as well as some of the diplomats, it just didn't coordinate with what they were saying when the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong launched this offensive. That just surprises. Westmoreland had been in D.C. in November of 1967 saying, you know, we can see some, we're winning, or we're closer and closer to winning. And it just blows the sort of the propaganda and the rosy projections of Hades. And as a result, leads Johnson to start questioning, and more importantly, it leads a lot of people around him to start questioning, including his new Secretary of Defense, Clark Clifford.
We are visiting with Professor Kyle Longley. He is the author of the book LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. In America's Year of Upheaval, are there any other years that compare to 1968? Some people might say, well, maybe perhaps 1861, you know, right at the beginning of the Civil War.
Right. Well, I think that's what the one you would look at, but, you know, that's a little different because it is a civil war that breaks out. This one appears like it might just pull the country apart, but you'll be hard-pressed to find years that are as pivotal as 1968. I think 1941, 1861, 1789, there's a few points in American history, but in modern American history, 1968, I think, is pivotal.
And it's interesting when people say, well, you know, back in the day or the good old days, not realizing that back in the day, there were some pretty tough years, and 1968 is one of those.
Well, definitely so. I use that all the time when someone's trying to tell me, it was so much better back when. And my first question is, in 1968, did you pay attention? Because, I mean, we've got assassinations, we've got a war in Vietnam, we got protests, we got race riots. You know, it just appears, like I say, the country is coming apart at the seams, and then you add in incidents like the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia. There's a Supreme Court nomination fight that sets the standard for even today. So it is this. Johnson referred to it as a year of a continuous nightmare, and I think that sums it up quite well.
And it didn't end in 1969 because what happened, some people thought, well, President Nixon is in office and things are going to look better, and as it turns out, it was another nightmare.
Well, it was, and much of the stage for that nightmare was laid in 1968, including the Chenault Affair toward the end, where the Nixon campaign actively interferes in the peace process in Paris in order to try to prevent a breakthrough, to try to prevent that from helping Hubert Humphrey win the White House. And some of the stage for Watergate is laid directly in that Chenault Affair.
You know, in reading that particular incident there, it seems like we're awfully close to what's going on now and perhaps what happened in the 2016 election.
Well, definitely so, where you see a campaign actively working with a foreign government to try to prevent, again, in this case, peace process. And some would use the term collusion. Some will say, you know, Richard Nixon was not involved. It was only his campaign. Others will say, well, the campaign was actively involved, but they didn't really make that much headway. The South Vietnamese were going to do this anyway and try to excuse it that way, and I think that's a major mistake. And again, I keep going back to 68 and 2018. There's a lot of resonance.
One of the things that we mentioned at the beginning of the interview, Kyle, is, of course, President Johnson being elevated to president when President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. So in 1968, when there is word that Dr. King has been shot, not killed yet, he gets that news later, that must have sent some big, awful feelings into President Johnson and him going back to Dallas.
Well, it was. And I think the King assassination, and then less than 3 months later, you have Robert Kennedy assassinated in Los Angeles. Those two, and, you know, he had built a lot of goodwill when he made his announcement not to seek re-election on March 31st, 1968. But 4 days later, 5 days later, here comes the assassination of King, and the country just erupts. Race riots in Detroit, you know, Chicago, even within 10 blocks of the White House, buildings are burning during these race riots. And Johnson, you know, like I say, I talk about this in the book, shows some significant restraint because there's a lot of people calling for the federal troops just to come in and just start shooting the places up. And he exercises and makes sure that those troops understand they're there to quell the riots, not to further exacerbate the killing of Americans by Americans.
And you mentioned in your book that he's talking to the officers and saying, make sure that there is not someone out there who is trigger happy or who's going to get too excited and shoot and perhaps create more chaos. But what I thought was interesting, too, is when you talk about the fact that there was so much going on in Washington that some of his advisors have to wait in line to use a public phone.
Oh, yeah. He sends out three people, including future Secretary of State Warren Christopher, to investigate. Just to see how bad it is, and they cannot even call in because all the circuits are down. and they have to go stand inside, wait for a payphone so that they can report back to the president, who then makes the decision to send in the federal troops. So, yeah, it's this whole just almost a comedy of errors if it wasn't such a serious event.
And when they found out that Dr. King had indeed been killed, he wanted to go to the funeral.
Yep.
But he was advised not to because there were some perhaps intelligence that said that someone might be out there angry at him.
Right. No, there's no doubt about it. And he would have had to go to Atlanta. And Atlanta had, you know, they talked about some of the, I hate to use the term, but it's the correct term, rednecks out there with long-range rifles, you know, just waiting to create chaos. And so he ultimately decided not to go, although he later will attend Robert Kennedy's, but he had been told by the Secret Service this is a very dangerous, they couldn't guarantee they could protect him. So he sent Hubert Humphrey instead and, you know, tried to control the situation as best as possible, given the circumstances. And it did. It appeared the country was coming apart at the seams by this point, and that a race war was, unfortunately, you know, possible.
We're visiting with Professor Kyle Longley. He's a professor of history at Arizona State University. His newest book is LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. It's no secret, Kyle, that President Johnson and Robert Kennedy did not see eye to eye. In fact, this goes back to when his brother selected him as his running mate. But when President Johnson announces that he's not going to seek re-election, Robert Kennedy goes to the White House and he's meeting with the president. And at this point, Robert has decided to throw his hat in the ring. But he's also wondering if President Johnson is going to rally behind him or if he's going to support his vice president.
And it's one of the, I think, the most interesting scenes in the book, and there are a lot of good ones in the book. But that scene of where Robert Kennedy comes to him to say, "Mr. President, are you going to let your cabinet members make a choice of who to support? You know, I know you're probably going to support Hubert Humphrey, but will you free these other people up?" And it's an interesting conversation that goes back and forth for a little while. And at the end, they leave on what appears like fairly cordial, conditions, but Johnson had secretly taped the meeting, but when they went to listen to the tape, there was nothing on it because Kennedy had not trusted him enough and had brought a scrambler and destroyed, basically made it where the tape couldn't work. So all we have are the notes of one of Johnson's advisors, but that shows the personal animosity as well as the suspicion between these two men. And one person has actively called it the feud that defined the 1960s, and I'm not sure that is not exactly correct.
I'm glad you brought that up because that was a fascinating part in the book where, again, someone intends to tape it, someone intends to make sure he doesn't tape it. And to me, also took me forward to the Watergate years when those minutes that were erased from the conversations in the Oval Office. So it was very interesting as you talked about it in your book about Kennedy and Johnson, again, not really trusting each other.
Gosh, it was a feud that is right up there, I would say, with Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr and Ulysses Grant and Charles Seward. I mean, there's some famous rivalries, political rivalries in American history, and the Johnson-RFK one is right up there at the top.
And so we fast forward to June of 1968, and Robert Kennedy has just won the primary in California. He makes his victory speech, and he's talking about going on to Chicago and winning there. But then tragedy strikes again.
And takes down another part of what most Americans would characterize as one of America's royal families. And it just brings back these haunting memories from 1963 of, you know, the death of John Kennedy. And it's just like the country is going, God, what more can this family endure? What more can we as a country endure with these political assassinations? And what ultimately happens, and I've just written a piece on this for coming up on the June deadline, is Johnson actually shows great empathy and sympathy toward the family, despite how they had their interactions over the decade. And, you know, first thing he does is he calls and comforts them. Second thing he does is he lines up a plane to pick up the Kennedy children and fly them to California to be with their fallen father. And then even at the funerals, he makes a special effort to show empathy. And another perfect scene in this book is when Johnson's in the back of the limo and they're going to the funeral or to the graveside at Arlington Cemetery. He's shedding tears, and Johnson did not shed tears, but he's shedding tears, especially for Rose Kennedy and the loss of all her sons, with the exception of Edward. And it's a significant moment of humanity that oftentimes Johnson is not perceived of as being able to show. There's caricatures of him as being crass and, you know, a bully. But there was a different side to him that this book, I think, brings out in much greater detail.
You know, one of the other scenes in the book where you picture him as not just the commander-in-chief, but also as a father and as a father-in-law, when his daughter has come back from San Diego and asking him, why are we even over there? There are
right.
people who don't care about us, and you send my husband over there.
Right, and that's Linda Robb, whose husband, Chuck Robb, had just been sent. But also Lucy, his other daughter's husband, Pat Nugent, was scheduled to be sent also to Vietnam. So he had a personal tie to Vietnam War now that was even intensifying what his hard feelings had already been. And this was a man that agonized over those that died in Vietnam. And that picture on the front, I think, just symbolizes that to a large degree, that this man cared. And yes, he was responsible. And many people will hold him and find him guilty of that, but he also had a human side to him that, again, very rarely was on display in public.
Tell us, shortly after the Kennedy assassination, Robert Kennedy, he wanted Congress to pass some tougher laws on gun control, and I couldn't help but thinking about what's going on today.
Oh, it is. I just finished another article on that that will hopefully be published here very soon. On that very issue of that he honored Martin Luther King after his death. He tried always to make lemonade out of lemons, and the way he honored King was to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1968 on fair housing. Well, he tried to do the same for Robert Kennedy on gun control, because Bobby Kennedy had been an active supporter of more stringent gun control laws. In fact, he'd spoken in Rosenberg, Oregon, just a few weeks before, where unfortunately there was a recent massacre just in the last couple of years at one of the schools. And so Johnson tried to honor him, but he ran headlong into the NRA. And he talked about to one of his advisors, we've got 2 weeks to beat the NRA into the offices of Congress or we're going nowhere. And they got beat.
We're visiting with Kyle Longley. Kyle is the author of the latest book, LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. Kyle, President Johnson announces to a national audience that he is not seeking re-election, and then there are people who are pushing him to reconsider as the 1968 convention starts in Chicago, but as people find out later that there's a lot more than just the president not seeking re-election, and there are some big clashes in Chicago.
Oh, yes. And I think that's a very strong chapter in terms of discussing the behind the scenes that I think a lot of people don't know that much about. But Johnson was orchestrating the convention from the ranch there in Stonewall and actively undermined Hubert Humphrey on a number of occasions just because of his own personal vanity relating especially to Vietnam. But, you know, he had in the back of his head, and I think one of the saddest scenes is that of that Tuesday morning of his birthday. And he's thinking that they're going to call him from Chicago and ask him to come up there and basically be the hero because Humphrey's down by about 17 points. Nobody really feels like Hubert Humphrey's going to be able to pull it off. It's, you know, there's riots in the streets, and Johnson's sitting there at the ranch expecting the phone call. But by the end of the afternoon, he's just got to give it up. The once most powerful man in the Democratic Party realizes and is being told by people that he doesn't need to come. And you just see the devastation on him, or, you know, you feel that for him. And, you know, he had undermined Humphrey on the Vietnam plane. Humphrey had fashioned a good compromise. Johnson undermines that, and then that leads to further turmoil on the floor there at the convention.
As you mentioned, the fact that it must have been a sad picture when he turns 60. He's waiting for that phone call. But then if you look at it from a different angle and going, you know what, if he had indeed run for re-election and won, I mean, people wonder, would he have made those 4 years? Because he died, what, 5 years later?
Yeah, he died the day at, just a couple of days after Nixon's inauguration in 1973. So that would be, it was one of the reasons he didn't seek re-election, and it's one of the reasons he gave for giving the March 31st speech, that and trying to seek peace in Vietnam. His family, he'd had a massive coronary in 1955, almost died. So he had a family history of strokes and heart attack. And, you know, he just felt like, he says at one point, I've got to escape this cage. I'm not going to make it anymore, he tells one of his advisors right on March 31st. And you see that playing out, whether he would have been able to make it that far. But that probably would have changed the dynamic of American history, because there is, you know, people will say, well, Johnson couldn't win in 1968. And I say, look at the final results. Hubert Humphrey almost came within just a hair of beating Richard Nixon, and he did it without any support of the South, and the South would have still supported their favorite son, Lyndon Johnson, or many Democrats would have voted for Lyndon Johnson that would not vote for Hubert Humphrey. So it could have changed the dynamics, and that would have changed the history of the United States. Richard Nixon doesn't come in. Watergate doesn't happen. Lyndon Johnson, if he does pass away, Hubert Humphrey moves into the White House. We probably would have got out of Vietnam very much faster, not had Cambodia and Laos and all the different things associated there related to the Nixon administration.
And as you write, after he gets that heart attack and they're flying him out to Austin, and when the doctor announces that he has already died, it's just, I don't know, every reader is going to interpret it differently, but it really hit me hard.
Yeah. Well, you know, he did do some things. You know, I talk about this on that scene, that last day in office in January of 1969. And, you know, the first thing he does when he boards the plane is he starts smoking again. He'd given that up in 1955, and the first thing he does is he lights up, and Lucy, his daughter, just goes ballistic, and he's like, I've given all for my country. I'm going to do what I enjoy now. And that further contributed to his ultimate heart attack. They couldn't get him to San Antonio on time, and he passes away. So, you know, a lot of it is there's a lot of people who hate him. There's a lot of people that look at him, and, you know, many of the people, when you look at his funeral procession, are African-American that recognize the changes that Lyndon Johnson made in the country for the betterment of people of color, including Latinos.
Kyle, thank you so much for being with us. Before we leave, is there a website that people can go to find out more about your book?
Yeah, I think, you know, the best things to do are still Amazon.com has a lot. Cambridge University Press, the publishers of the book, have put up a lot of good materials. And, you know, just doing searches. I don't have a particular website for it, but hopefully if they have questions, they can find those. And, you know, just do a quick search and it will come up.
Thank you, Kyle. We've been visiting with Kyle Longley. Kyle is the author of the book, LBJ's 1968, Power Politics and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. Kyle Longley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.